The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Graham, Science Online News Editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about kids over-imitating adults. In what way, Dave?
Well, Rob, this story is all about how when kids watch an adult do something, they mimic everything that adult does, even really useless actions. So, for example, researchers have run experiments where they hide a toy, say, in a box. And there's a very easy way to open that box. All the adult has to do is maybe open a latch and it opens the box. But before they do that, maybe they'll rub a feather over the box and then open the latch and open the box. So this whole feather thing is completely irrelevant to getting the toy. But if the kid watches that being done, the kid will imitate all the adult's actions. He or she will go over to the box, they'll wave the feather around the box, and then they'll open the latch and get the toy. Whereas if researchers do this with other primates, say like chimpanzees, chimpanzees completely disregard the whole thing with the feather. They go, what's the minimum amount of work I need to do to get this toy or this treat? And they do it. And researchers have wondered, is this something that's hardwired into humans? Because if it is, it may have something to do with how we transmit culture. This has been, you know, a really fascinating topic in anthropology, is how does culture get passed from one person to another? And one could envision if we're really imitating everything somebody else does, especially as we develop as a child, maybe that's an important way for us to transmit culture.
So how do you see whether or not this is really hardwired in people?
Well, in these previous studies, researchers had really only looked at children from Western societies and children that tended to be more middle or upper class. And so to really see if this behavior was universal, they wanted to look at a completely different society. And they looked at the Kalahari Bushmen. And what's different about children that grew up, say, in the Kalahari Desert versus in the study they compared them to kids that grew up in the Australian suburbs is that, say, an adult from the Australian suburbs wants to teach a kid how to use a bow and arrow. You know, maybe dad will come over to his daughter and, you know, stand behind her as she, you know, pulls back the bow and he'll correct her form and tell her what she's doing right and doing wrong, a very hands-on training approach. But in the Kalahari, if an adult wants to teach a child how to use a bow and arrow, the adult will maybe take the child out on a hunt and the adult will use the bow and arrow and never really let the child use it and just assume that the child will observe their actions and learn from trial and error on their own. And so it's a very hands-off approach. And so what they did in the study was they compared these two groups of children, and they did something very similar to that box test that we talked about. And you can actually see a video of it on the site.
The one where the kid, like, waves a feather.
Right. I think in this case, they're just rubbing a stick on the box before they open it. So again, this really sort of, you know, tangential and really useless action to get what's ever inside the box. And what the researchers found that was really surprising to them was that it didn't matter what culture the child grew up in, they all imitated this useless action of rubbing the stick on the box before going ahead and opening the box. And that suggests to the researchers that this behavior of over-imitating adults is really a universal behavior. It's something that's really hardwired into us as human beings. And therefore, it may be a very important mechanism for how culture gets transmitted from person to person.
What would be the reason evolutionarily for such a behavior to evolve?
Well, regardless of what's going on with culture, what the researchers think is, you know, at least on a basic level, what's happening here is that for humans, it seems to be important or maybe evolutionarily important that we know the way things are done, not what gets done. So unlike a dog or maybe a chimpanzee that just goes and says, I want to get what's in the box and here's the fastest way to do it, humans really want to know the whole process that surrounds that. And they really want to sort of understand that entire process. And that seems to be a part of us regardless of where or how we grow up.
So perhaps this over-imitation is a consequence of other things that benefit our overall learning.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, speaking of relationships between adults and children, this next story is about how a relationship with a father and his offspring actually helps grow new neurons in the father's brain.
Offspring, huh? What species are we talking about here?
Right. Well, we're not talking about humans. Otherwise, I probably would have said children or kids. This study deals with mice. It has to do with this idea of neurogenesis, which is new neuron growth in the brain. And why do we or other species sometimes grow new neurons? And what's the purpose of it all? And researchers already know that female mice, when they smell the pheromones of dominant male mice, will grow new neurons in two key structures of their brain, the olfactory bulb and the hippocampus, which coordinate the memory of odors. And the idea is if they grow more of these structures, then they'll be even more attuned to these odors and they'll be able to better pick out, say, a dominant male mouse out of a, you know, a whole herd of male mice and be able to pick the best father for their offspring and therefore give their offspring the best shot at life. And researchers wanted to see if something very similar was going on with fathers and their pups. The idea would be if fathers spent more time nurturing their pups, maybe they would grow structures in their brain that might help their offspring survive better in life. And so what the researchers did in this study was they took a bunch of male and female mice, they let them mate and produce offspring, and then they separated the fathers into three groups. Some of the fathers they took out of this cage right away. So as soon as the pups were born, the fathers were removed. And in other cases, they let the fathers hang around and nuzzle with the mother and the pups and really sort of be a father, be a dad, be a good mouse dad. And in the final case, they let the mouse fathers stay in the cage, but they didn't let them actually have physical interaction with their pups. And then all these mice were reintroduced to their pups about 6 weeks later. And then the researchers selected for the mice that seemed to recognize their pups. And the way they determined this was the male mice spent more time sniffing their sons and they didn't attack them. So, you know, mouse father-child relationships are a little different than human relationships.
So that's what you meant by getting along a little better in life.
Exactly. But what the researchers found was that these mouse fathers that recognized their sons were also the fathers that had spent more time nuzzling their sons. And we're only talking about sons here because the researchers removed daughters from the equation. Fathers tend to try to mate with their daughters. So the researchers didn't want that confusing the results here. And the fathers that had nuzzled with their sons had more neurons in these same two brain regions we had talked about earlier, the olfactory bulb and the hippocampus, suggesting that perhaps they were sensing something, picking up a scent or some other chemical cue from their son that was causing them to grow more neurons in these brain regions.
So a link between neurons and memories.
Well, kind of. I mean, I think the more important link here is that, you know, in an ideal world, fathers really want to potentially create this stronger bond with their offspring because they want to nurture particularly their own offspring to give them the best shot at life, just like we humans would. And so the idea is if they've got sort of more enhanced brain structures, they're very able to do this. And the researchers say that, you know, this may translate to humans as well. You know, there are a lot of parallels. Despite the fact that fathers usually don't attack their sons after they're born in human society, there actually are a lot of physiological parallels between mice and humans. And the researchers say there may be parallels here as well. Perhaps human fathers also grow new neurons when sons and daughters are born.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from fathers getting along with their sons, this last story is about two species that definitely don't get along with each other. It's about the first published example of a plant competing with an animal for the same resources.
Which resource?
Well, the resource here is bugs, and specifically bugs like flies, ants, crickets, and springtails.
And what's the animal?
The animal is the insect-eating wolf spider.
So could the plant eat that spider?
The plant does not eat that spider, as far as we know. But what the plant does, and the plant we're talking about here is called a sundew, and these plants have very sticky leaves, and the leaves trap a lot of the same insects that the wolf spiders eat. The wolf spiders obviously trap the insects with their webs. The plants trap the insects with these mucousy, sticky leaves, and they digest them with digestive enzymes. And both of these organisms inhabit very similar ecological niches. They both live close to the ground, and they live in the damp bogs of southern Florida. Now, initially, researchers really wouldn't pay much attention to this, because a lot of times, usually when we think about competition, we think about competition between two very closely related species. You think about maybe a cheetah trying to outrun a lion to grab a gazelle, or two different trees that are very close together, maybe one tree trying to produce more leaves or more roots so it gets more sunlight or water than the other tree.
So what was the clue that these two species were competing with one another?
Well, first there was the clue that they both seem to be eating the same types of things, and they seem to be living in very similar areas. And so the researcher said, you know, with so much overlap, I wonder if these guys are competing with each other for food. And that's exactly what they found. They found that in the wild, when the spiders were living very close to these sundews, the spiders tended to produce much larger webs than when they were living by themselves, indicating that they were trying to outcompete the plants for catching insects. And to see how the sundews were responding, the researchers actually had to take everything back to the lab and put it in a terrarium. And here what they found was when the sundews were growing by themselves, they tended to flourish. They grew big leaves and they produced a lot of seeds. But when the spiders were introduced, the spiders started immediately grabbing a lot of the insects that the researchers had put in the terrarium for the plants to feed on. And as a result, the plants really started to suffer. They produced a lot fewer seeds and smaller leaves, indicating that they were sort of losing out on this competition with the spiders. So overall, some nice evidence that a plant would compete with an animal for the same food, something you wouldn't normally expect to see.
Well, I'm more convinced by what was going on in the wild than what was going on in the lab, with the spider web being bigger. Could it be, instead of competition in the wild anyway, that there's actually symbiosis going on here?
Well, I agree with you, Rob. I think the wild study is more convincing than the study in the lab. And as one of our readers pointed out, it could be that the spiders may be setting up shop near the plants to take advantage of all the insects that these plants are drawing in. So it could be the system is a lot more complicated than the study suggests.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about how blue light, and this is the light emitted by computer screens and other devices, may actually impact your circadian rhythms. And these are the rhythms that are very important for controlling our hunger, our sleep-wake cycle, a lot of daily processes that go on in our body. So potentially very interesting study there. And also a study about the first example of full body transfer in virtual reality, how volunteers put on virtual reality goggles and assume the persona of a young teenage girl being slapped by her mother. So check both of those out on Science Now. And then for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we continue to follow this giant oil spill in the Gulf Coast and how scientists are getting involved. First of all, what scientists think the causes of the spill were, and also how scientists are helping to lend their knowledge to help clean up the spill. And we've also got a story about the battle over scientific whaling, and you can find out what that's about and more about all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories from the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.